Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
In the spotlight is D.H. Lawrence, the great and controversial novelist, and Richard Kaye, professor of literature in the English department at Hunter College, part of the City University system in Manhattan. Since 2017, Richard Kaye has been the editor of the D.H. Lawrence Review, the 50-year-old journal dealing with the life and work of the British writer. Richard Kaye's other areas of interest include Victorian literature and culture, the history of the novel, modernism, World War I literature, psychoanalysis, queer theory, and visual culture. He is author of The Flirt's Tragedy, Desire Without End in Victorian and Edwardian Fiction. He has published essays on Edith Wharton, the Bronte sisters, Charles Dickens, George Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, T.S. Eliot, and of course, D.H. Lawrence, Wallace Stevens, Henry James, Sylvia Plath, and so on. He's taught courses on Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters, as well as Thomas Hardy, Edith Wharton, Victorian literature, asceticism, and other areas. Broad interest here, all of it having to do with great writing, though, and communication. Richard Kaye, thank you for joining us.
It's good to talk to you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're the right guy to talk D.H. Lawrence, given the journal that you edit and all the background that you've got. But, you know, before we discuss the life of D.H. Lawrence, what about the history of the novel? I want to ask you about that. Was Philip Roth correct when he said that the era of the novel is over? What would you say about both the history of the novel and its place in current times?
Oh, that's quite a question. I wonder if Philip Roth said that right before passing away, you know, the novel. Now,
I think it was after he retired, so it didn't matter. It didn't matter anymore.
That might be a little self-serving, but I don't think the novel is over. I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction, but now and then I'll read something really terrific and gives me hope for the novel, which, by the way, in one of his famous statements, D.H. Lawrence referred to the novel as, quote, the bright book of life. And he meant that to mean that the novel, above all other kinds of writing, was unique and special and linked to life in very deep ways. So it's Lawrence thought about that a lot. To relate Lawrence to the history of the novel, when I teach Lawrence, I teach him in a class with the Brontes, all three of the Bronte sisters, and Thomas Hardy, and we end with Lawrence because I think he's part of an English tradition in the novel that's interested in nature, that's interested in the natural landscape, that's interested in romantic and sexual issues. So he doesn't just come out of nowhere, Lawrence. He really builds on this tradition, and he actually writes an entire book on Thomas Hardy. He's quite obsessed with the author of Tess of the D'Urbervilles and Jude the Obscure and other works. And it's a really fine piece of literary criticism. And it shows that Lawrence was aware of his relation to a certain English literary tradition, not Jane Austen, right? But the Bronte sisters.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So just for any listeners who it's kind of like, yeah, D.H. Lawrence, I know the name, I'm listening because I want to learn more. D.H. Lawrence is David Herbert Lawrence. He was born in 1885. He died in March 1930. English novelist, short story writer, poet, essayist, And his modernist works reflect on modernity, social alienation, and industrialization. He championed sexuality, vitality, and instinct. And among the novels that he's known for, well, Lady Chatterley's Lover is his most famous, but by no means his only great novel. He also wrote one called Sons and Lovers, another called The Rainbow, another called Women in Love. They were subject to censorship trials for their radical portrayals of sexuality. Radical at the time. Today, very tame by today's standard, but radical at the time, he used explicit language. And I will say that Lady Chatterley's Lover, I've known for, of course, for decades. It was only recently I read it because the Netflix ran a movie about it. And I thought, you know, I haven't even read that novel. And I was telling Richard the other day, before we recorded this podcast, that I don't tend to go back in time novels that are that old because they feel dated to me. I did not get that sense at all with Lady Chatterley's Lover. It felt very contemporary. The writing was, and of course, I was curious about the sexuality, which, as I say, was very tame. However, the writing itself, high quality writing. I mean, literature. He was a great writer, and so just to frame that, and he's regarded really as one of the greatest writers of his century. Richard, what else might you say about D.H. Lawrence to frame him for listeners who are just trying to come to know him?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad to hear you think he's not dated, and I've never heard that charge against Lawrence, though he's controversial for all sorts of reasons. But one framework that I think is important for him, since you mentioned that he's a modernist writer, alone among major modernist writers, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, Joseph Conrad, Thomas Mann, I could go on and on. Lawrence was a working class writer. His father was a coal miner. Lawrence's second novel, very autobiographical, was about growing up in a coal mining community in the Midlands. So I always stress that with Lawrence because it tends to drop out of a discussion that focuses on the sexual aspects of his work, the scandal of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which of course ran into censorship troubles both in the United States and in Britain, that were ultimately resolved in Lawrence's favor. It wasn't the first work of his to run into controversy. That was really the case with an earlier novel, The Rainbow, which had a scene in it. It seems comical to us that this would have upset the censors, but there's a scene in it where a pregnant woman, Anna, dances in front of the moon. And this was considered wildly provocative, and it got that novel into a lot of trouble. So he often ran into censorship obstacles for his fiction, though for sure Lady Chatterley's Lover was the one that really involved a big set of trials in London and one in America. Several broke out elsewhere, and that really, in a way, put him on the map as a dangerous writer, if you will.
Yeah. So how long was it banned for? Lady Chatterley's Lover, let's just take that one for starters. That was banned for how many years?
Well, it was a complicated history. You could get copies that were pirate editions, but
black market stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You could find, I think there were copies that were circulating, in Italy, for example, that, you know, people were able to get their hands on it, but it culminated in this big trial in London that a lot of people were interested in. And I even came upon some letters by the poet Sylvia Plath, and she attended the trial. She was really interested in D.H. Lawrence. She was in Cambridge as a Fulbright fellow, and someone gave her a ticket. Stephen Spender gave her a ticket to the to the trial over Lady Chatterley's Lover, and she went, and she was very excited by it. So
yeah, and she was a very sexually robust woman. I mean, I recently read her big biography by Heather Clark, I think, who was the author. So I can see what the attraction was there for sure.
Well, Platt loved Lawrence, and she writes in her diary that there are two writers she wants to really model herself after. And it's hard to think of a writer modeling him or herself after these two writers, but she chose Lawrence and Henry James as the two writers she imagined. And then sometimes she would mention Virginia Woolf. But to go back to my earlier point, I think Lawrence always, saw himself in terms of this working class experience, and saw himself as someone who confronted the Industrial Revolution, which he viewed with great skepticism and hostility. And so that's one framework in which I think it's important to think of Lawrence. And he was also importantly a writer who traveled a lot. He, went to Italy, he went to Mexico, he went to New Mexico, he went to France, where he ultimately died. But he was quite a wanderer. Over the years, he became more and more alienated from Britain, really, particularly after his experience of the First World War, where he and his wife, Frida, were spied on because the authorities were concerned that Frida, who was German by birth, might be a spy. So they had a rough time of it during the first.
So they both were viewed with suspicion, him for being being perverse by some people's estimation, or her being a potential spy. Yeah. Interesting. I didn't know about the spy allegation.
And of course, she was a controversial woman because she had left her husband and children to marry Lawrence. I mean, that was quite a scandalous thing in that time. And she had trouble seeing her children at certain points. So it was a sensational life in many ways, and yet in other ways, not. But certainly when they met, it was, there was kind of sensational magic there, and he won her over.
Much like in Lady Chatterley's Lover. I mean, in a sense, I mean, a woman falls in love with her husband, but falls out of love with her husband after he suffers a war injury and really is no longer able to perform. So she pursues a tort affair with a gamekeeper on their estate, and begins there's an affair there. There's an affair, which of course, and this is depicted in that 2022 Netflix, just last year, 2 years ago, let's make that, Netflix released a movie. And it was a good movie. I had not read the book yet, but the movie was good. I'm glad I saw the movie before the book, or I would have felt, because once I read the book, I realized, wow, they really took a very narrow aspect of the book. But what did you think of the movie, Richard? I know you saw it.
I liked many aspects of it. It's not my favorite adaptation of Lawrence. Lawrence has been done pretty well with film adaptation. And I'm never quite totally in love with any of those films, but over the years, there've been adaptations of Women in Love and The Rainbow, two novels that were adapted by the British director Ken Russell. There was a movie in the 1950s, an adaptation of Lawrence's story, The Rocking Horse Winner. So there are a couple of quite fine adaptations of Lawrence. And in the case of Women in Love, that Ken Russell movie, that film did a lot to bring Lawrence to the attention of popular audiences in a way that, you know, was not true before. I mean, Women in Love, which I think was came out in 1970, it was one of the 8 most popular films in Britain in 1970. So it was a big deal with Alan Bates and Glenda Jackson and Oliver Reed. That really brought Lawrence to a new public, and it coincided, and this is an important point I would make, with the new counterculture, with the sexual liberationist movement of the 1960s and 70s. And so Lawrence benefited from that. You know, the popular version of him was as a writer who heralded and supported free love, the natural life, nature, getting away from technology. Some of these aspects of Lawrence's appeal, I think, have made him appealing today to today's readers, where, you know, we're living at a moment when technology seems to imperil our daily lives. And Lawrence offers a way out of that in many of his novels. Most of his writing is interested in how to, you know, free oneself from
Kinds of strictures, right? Kinds of strictures, including the mores of the day. But he was not a perverted man. My understanding is he deplored pornography, that was not his thing. And, but he seemed to, you check me on this, Richard, but he seemed to be a person that understood that nature had imbued us with these desires and these things that, let's just put it that way, these desires, and that because it was natural, there was nothing untoward about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ironies of Lawrence having this reputation of being a sexual provocateur is that in some ways he was quite puritanical in his attitudes. I mean, he was, as you say, he wrote a pamphlet on not exactly denouncing pornography, but seeing it as very different from the erotic writing, erotic painting. He was a man who remained married to the same woman all his life. So he was by no means some kind of, you know, Byronic naughty boy.
He did have one affair, did he not? She had some affairs, right? At least one affair, and he had one. Is that right? Or maybe just a dalliance would be better, because I think the woman who he slept with said it happened one time.
Yeah, we're not quite sure. We didn't have Access Hollywood in those days, so we can't be sure. But they weren't. Yeah, they. I think true to the sort of circles they traveled in Europe and New Mexico, there was some playing around. But Lawrence was not someone who believed in the erotic life as separate from civic life, from being a loving husband, he had complicated ideas, but I think now and then you'll read in his letters him denouncing certain people for being, what to use the term you used, perverse. So he could be very judgmental. And yet at the same time, he's quite extraordinary. I mean, one aspect of his writing that makes him continually interesting and popular is he does have a good part of his fiction is interested in male and female same-sex erotics, lesbianism, homosexuality. His novel, The Rainbow, upset some readers because of its depiction of a romantic affair between a woman, Ursula, and her an older woman, very, very passionate affair between two women. And then famously in the novel Women in Love, there's a very close physical bond between two men, the characters Rupert Birkin and Gerald Kreitch. And this led, the scene where these two guys wrestle naked was one of the most sensational part of that 1970 Ken Russell movie, which, you know, people were really, you know, I think it's fair to say the reaction was from shock to fascination. So he was known for his bold depiction of all kinds of erotic impulses, more so than I would say all those other modernist writers. There's only one modernist writer, I think, who has fared as well in contemporary film as well as Lawrence, and that's probably Joseph Conrad, because of the Francis Ford Coppola adaptation of Heart of Darkness, Apocalypse Now. You know, that gave a huge boost to Joseph Conrad. And Lawrence is really the only other writer I can think of who has had a similarly successful fate in cinema and film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that he moved around a lot, but he was exiled from his own country. I mean, and the reason had to do with he grows up or was living in a town called Eastwood. And these novels he wrote, he was writing about local people and he never even bothered to change their names, is my understanding. Why would that be? Why would he not at least change the names so that it wasn't didn't impugn them?
I think he did change the names, but they were so clearly referencing certain individuals. I learned, for example, I went to visit Lawrence's hometown of Eastwood, and there's a very wealthy family that's still owns a house, a manor house in Eastwood. And Lawrence depicted the family in his novel, Women in Love, with enough telling details that the family knew that they were being depicted. For example, he referenced one of the sons accidentally killing his brother. This led, you know, when I was in Eastwood, I was told I could not walk on the property and try to talk to the people who lived there because it was still the family. And they were still 100 years later angry. The descendants were angry at Lawrence for how he had depicted their family. Wow. So, you know,
Is there no marker in Eastwood today? No statue, no marker, no nothing that.
There are markers, just not everywhere. And his home, you can visit his childhood home, one of his childhood homes. It's a museum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lovely little museum. But to go back to something you said, Mike, he did travel a lot because of his feelings of persecution in Britain, but he also traveled a lot to warmer climates because of ill health. And Lawrence had tuberculosis, so he was constantly seeking out warmer climates like Italy, New Mexico, Mexico. So it was also a health issue. And mm-hmm. and also he had this obsession, fascination with America, with Mexico. One of his novels, The Plumed Serpent, is set in Mexico. There's a big D.H. Lawrence conference in about a year that's going to take place in Mexico. I think it's the first time there's been a conference there. So he did love to travel, and he would write about the places he visited in wonderful, really some of them are classics of travel literature, like Mornings in Mexico. Another book is Etruscan Places. So he admired and wrote about what he considered cultures that lived closer to the land and that were not bedeviled by all the things that civilized people, in Lawrence's view, are bedeviled by. He loved the Italians. He loved the Indian tribes that he encountered in New Mexico, in Mexico. He wrote a lot about those kinds of cultures.
Now, he also said about New Mexico, I believe I'm quoting here, he said, or something to this effect, it was New Mexico that liberated me from the present era of civilization. The moment I saw the brilliant, proud morning shining high over the desert of Santa Fe, something stood still in my soul.
Wow, that's a beautiful passage and well conveys really how beautifully Lawrence could evoke the feelings that a place like New Mexico evoked in him. Gosh, you could put that on a travel poster for the tourist trade to New Mexico. But yeah, he had a very, I mean,
it was his favorite place, wasn't it? Didn't he say that was his favorite place? I believe he's buried there, isn't he?
No,
in New Mexico.
No, he's actually buried in France.
In France, he is in France. Yeah. Okay,
but there's actually, it's a whole other story for a whole other conversation. But we don't quite know where his ashes are. There's some mystery about that. But there is, though, because he spent time in New Mexico in Taos, there is a tribute to him, a house and a plaque and a lot there that memorializes Lawrence.
Why a house? Is that where he stayed when he was in
Taos? Yeah, he stayed there with a friend of his, an American woman named Mabel Dodge Lujan, who lived in New Mexico. She was an artist. She was part of an artist colony down there. And he stayed there, and if you go to visit this home in New Mexico, you're a little taken back by how small and modest these homes are. Lawrence loved modest living and he loved, you know, housekeeping and cooking, but he lived in this, a modest home could make him very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I don't want to, you know, I don't want to avoid emphasizing just how famous Lawrence was. You know, on one of his visits to New York City, he was wined and dined by the literary elite in New York. They took him out to dinner. There are accounts of him being very grumpy about all this attention. But really, from the very beginning of his career, he was admired, and not so much by a huge reading public, but by other writers and critics. He was a figure of fascination. And so in the beginning, from almost the very outset of his career, he made his mark.
Well, and they saw the talent and the bravery. Right. I mean, they could see the talent that he had. And on top of that, he risked an awful lot by writing what he really felt like he needed to write.
Yeah. And he's also, you know, a model for many writers because he really lived off his writing. You know, he's one of the reasons he was so productive. I mean, I'm looking at my shelf here with some 25 volumes of the Cambridge edition of D.H. Lawrence. He wrote for magazines. He wrote because he needed to earn a living from his writing. And I think that makes him a very attractive figure. And I like the word you use, Mike, which I think is very important with Lawrence, the word brave. You know, he knew he was going to get in trouble for some of those novels. He knew that he was going to scandalize people by running off with a married woman. And she was, by the way, she was, it's worth noting, Frieda was from a fancy German family. I mean, she was related to the Red Baron, the famous aviator, the famous German aviator. So she was in some ways, in many ways, a high-born lady who fell madly in love with this working class struggling writer. So they have a rather, I think it's worth pausing there to, because part of the myth of Lawrence, the myth of D.H. Lawrence, is this romantic figure who, you know, stole another man's wife and they lived tumultuously, but I don't think anyone has ever questioned it was one of the great couples of the early part of the 20th century.
You know, my notes here say, and I've cribbed notes from some documentaries on him, some YouTube documentaries. And one of them had said that on completing the first draft of Lady Chatterley's Lover in 1927, Lawrence wrote, and I quote, "I've done my novel. I like it, but it's so improper, according to the poor conventional fools, that it will never be printed." And he did end up getting it printed. But as you say, there was a lot of having to be black market copies. But he wrote what he wanted. You know, they went on to say that he was much happier. He was a much happier writer when he was just writing what he wanted to write rather than feeling that he needed to shape his writing according to publishing standards. And, you know, I've talked about this on the podcast before that I think that's a major handicap for people who are aspiring writers who are writing novels. They want to sound like a novelist is supposed to sound. They want to sound like what is being produced today rather than, well, their instincts might be telling them something different, but they tame those. They set those aside and they just decide, I'm going to sound like other people who are writing books today. In reality, today, I think there's every flavor out there. But do you come across all of them? No, because there's just so many books, you can't get to them all. But Lawrence, I think he just recognized that in himself, that he had to write. There was no joy in doing the writing unless he was writing what was at his core.
Yeah, I think he was one of the great believers in the deep connection between writing and living. It's hard to explain this, but I think this is particularly evident in his poetry, which, you know, many critics have had trouble with because some of it is free form. It doesn't seem to be that interested in formal technique, but he very much had a belief in the connections between life and literature, life and writing. And he was an obsessive writer. I mean, there's an account I read by Rebecca West of him arriving in a foreign city, I'm forgetting which one, and before even spending time in the city, he sat down at a desk and started to write about this place. It's like, as if like I can absorb it through my, you know, through my skin. And she thought this was kind of amusing, but she thought it was part of his genius. And by the way, that's a word that got used about Lawrence all the time, to the point where he said somewhat resentfully, "People are always telling me I have genius," as if to compensate for my not having other qualities, which is a funny remark. But
yes,
he was aware of this reputation. And, you know, there's a biography of Lawrence by his friend Richard Aldington, which is entitled Portrait of a Genius, But.
Yeah.
There is another, you know, you talk about the issue of influence. I think one interesting thing about Lawrence is I think he's a very hard, difficult writer for writers to imitate. unlike, say, a writer like Hemingway, who, you know, is known for having really influenced a lot of writers who came after him. Something about Hemingway's style makes him a model for other writers. I think it's a mistake for writers to try to imitate Lawrence. It doesn't take you to good places. I'm not sure why that's the case, but I think it is. I think he's hard to duplicate in a contemporary idiom, if you will.
Right. Yeah. You know, do we know how Frida regarded her husband's writing? Was she, did she feel that he was crossing a line? Was she down with it? Do we have any knowledge of that, whether Frida was supportive or not?
Yes, we know a lot about Frida because she wrote a memoir of her time with Lawrence. And she was a huge supporter, if you will. I'm not sure they used that word back then, but she loved his writing. And she, after his death, she, you know, made a point of promoting it and showing admiration for it. Now, one curious thing is this is going to change next year. Frida's letters have never been published, and I'm happy to say next year there's a volume of her letters that's being published by Louisiana State University Press. So we'll learn more about Frida's perspective. The story isn't over yet as far as what she thought about her husband. It's only a selection of her letters, but I'm very excited about that coming out finally.
Now, is this, I noticed there's one here called Frida Lawrence in Her Circle, Letters From, To, and About Frida Lawrence. That's not the same book then, right? Because this one already appears to be out.
No, that's a relatively small selection. This is going to be a substantial collection of her letters. You know, she lived a long life, and so we'll there's a lot to choose from, but you know, that's a different volume.
Now, what about influence in terms of Frida influencing her husband's writing? Was she ever a subject of the writing? How much did she influence it? Or maybe even influence him to continue on versus giving up? I'm not sure that he was a guy who could give up, because he almost seems like a kind of guy who needed to write, like a lot of inveterate writers. It's just, I can't not write, or I'm going to jump off a bridge.
Yeah, I don't think she had a strictly speaking, an influence on him. However, you know, to go back to Lady Chatterley's Lover, there are biographers and critics who think, you know, he's rendering a version of his own story with Frida, and that, you know, that Lawrence is in a sense the gamekeeper Mellors, and Connie Chatterley is Frida. I don't think that takes you very far, but in terms of understanding the novel Lady Chatterley's Lover, but there's no way around the fact that there's a rough approximation of Lawrence's own story there. I mean, the Lady Chatterley is, you know, she's in a very conventional proper marriage, and there's something about Mellors which, you know, excites her. And I don't just, you know, to go back to something you were saying earlier, Mike, I don't think it was just that in the novel that Lady Chatterley's husband can't perform. I think it's more that Clifford Chatterley represents an old, desiccated England that for Lawrence went along with the war, that allowed the First World War to happen. So Clifford becomes a representative of this whole class of people who led millions to their deaths in the First World War. So it's bigger. It's he has a lot of symbolic weight, Clifford Chatterley, in that novel, beyond, you know, not being able to satisfy Connie sexually.
Now, my understanding is there that the there's a Chatterley family in Eastwood that he named the husband and wife after a family that was in Eastwood where he was living and grew up.
Yeah, I think
is that true?
Yeah, I think I read that some time ago, but I don't think it's they were actually the, you know, that the scenario is based on that family. I mean, he used a lot of names that didn't actually mean more beyond that, you know, him liking the sound of the name. So it's not, I wouldn't see a biographical dimension to that. But he did, I mean, to be fair, to be clear, he did hurt a lot of people by putting them in his fiction. So for example, in Sons and Lovers, his first girlfriend is a character in that novel, and she was very hurt. This Jessie Chambers was her name, and she wrote her own kind of memoir to give her version. And similarly, in Women in Love, there's a rather ludicrous character, the character of Hermione Roddice. That character was based on a very famous hostess of her time, and that Lady Adeline Morrill. And she too was offended. And Lawrence, you know, wasn't, you know, I'll be clear here, he wasn't very nice to those people. But like a lot of artists, I mean, they're, it's innumerable writers, he wanted material for his fiction. So, you know, yeah. a certain kind of writer is going to, what is that Joan Didion line that everyone's always quoting? A writer is always selling somebody out.
Yeah, I believe that's right. And then also Philip Roth said, if there's a writer in the family, the family is doomed, basically. Yes. That's not exact, but yeah, if there's a writer in the family is doomed.
Yeah, and that was certainly the case with Lawrence, and he in that sense, he put his literary art above the people in his life, and there were a lot of wounded people who get, now he's not the only writer to do that, you know.
No, Albert, many have.
Yeah, and also just speaking of Lawrence's circle, he was very close to Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley's wife was with Lawrence when Lawrence died in France. But Aldous Huxley also satirized Lady Adeline Morrill in his novel, Chrome Yellow. So she seems to have been a target, that particular hostess, of a lot of writers who she was very generous with them, but they needed to skewer her in his fiction. But, you know, that's unfortunate, but I don't think you can get away from just how, you know, great the achievement of a novel like Sons and Lovers. I mean, we don't read that novel concerned about people who are now dead. We want to know what, you know,
what's the story? Give us the story. Give us the electric writing. Now, D.H., one of the marks of distinction about D.H. Lawrence, at least what I've been told, excuse me, my phone was just going off, is that he was the first author, the first male author anyway, who wrote about sex from a woman's point of view.
I think there's a lot of truth in that remark. Not the very first, I suppose, because, you know, think of there're not certain novels by Thomas Hardy, Jude the Obscure, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, do give you a sense of women's attitude about sex and sexuality. You know, there's a scene in Jude the Obscure where the character of Sue Bridehead, she's really not sexually interested in her husband, Richard. And she, when he makes a move on her in bed, she jumps out the window.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, but I think you're mostly right, Mike, in that he was very interested in women's view of their sexuality. It's all over the fiction, which, you know, I should mention here that, you know, despite that, despite Lawrence's interest in narrating a woman's character's point of view when it comes to erotic matters, he got into a lot of trouble with feminists in the 1970s with the publication, I think it was 1970, 1971, Kate Millett's book, Sexual Politics.
Yes.
Right, where Kate Millett went after Lawrence, Norman Mailer, Henry Miller. And I don't particularly like that book, but there's no way around it. It made a huge impact on Lawrence's reputation. And Kate Millett, that book started as a Columbia PhD dissertation in English. It landed Kate Millett on the cover of Time magazine. And so a lot of people learned about Lawrence from Kate Millett in the 70s. Now I think that's an important classic book of feminist criticism, but it competed with some of those popular culture adaptations of Lawrence's fiction, like Women in Love, you know, which came out almost the same year as Sexual Politics, Kate Millett's book. In which, you know, you had characters played by, you know, the Ursula from Women in Love is played by Glenda Jackson. And it's a very glamorous version of a free liberated woman. So it's a complicated story of how Lawrence fared in the 1970s. But I know today a lot of my women students are drawn to Lawrence. They're interested in, I guess the word is reclaiming him for feminist criticism. And I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of women writers have made clear how much they admire Lawrence. I'll mention a few names. Doris Lessing, the Nobel mm-hmm. laureate Doris Lessing, mm-hmm. Admired Lawrence enormously, had written about him. And I mentioned Sylvia Plath already, and also the contemporary American writer Joyce Carol Oates, who mm-hmm. wrote a beautiful book on Lawrence's poetry called The Hostile Sun. And she's written about women and love, and she's an admirer. So I think, you know, Lawrence has fared well among a lot of women writers, even though it needs to be said, there is a whole feminist perspective on Lawrence that sees him as a problem because, how can I make this terse? Because he's often fascinated by women who submit to men. Mm. And their, you know, sort of masculine sexual authority, you know, and there are weird Lawrence novels that are really, you know, there's a novel by Lawrence it's a novella really called The Woman Who Rode Away, about a woman who goes off to be sacrificed by an Indian tribe in Mexico. And she seems to welcome this sacrifice. So it's very, he goes off in some very peculiar, weird directions now and then, which are kind of hard to excuse from a sort of socially correct way, from a socially correct perspective. So it's complicated, I think.
Right, right. At the same time, though, Frieda had affairs during the marriage and he tolerated them. So he was not a command and control sort, not entirely, that's for sure, because he never would have tolerated that.
Well, they did have a famously tumultuous marriage. I mean, he tolerated it, but you know, lots of descriptions of people going over to the Lawrences for dinner and then, you know, throwing crockery at each other. So it was,
well, there's a great scene for a novel.
Yeah, there's lots of, you know, there's lots of stories of how tumultuous that marriage was, but it endured.
Yeah. Well, and I guess the makeup sex, they always say makeup sex is the best. So.
There you go.
So in 1925, he is diagnosed with tuberculosis. Now, he didn't die until 1930. And so for 5 years, he was, beleaguered by that disease. And you mentioned moving to warm climates. He was in Sicily. He was in Florence. He was in Mexico. He was in New Mexico, probably breathing a little bit more freely in places like that, especially kind of the dry, high desert in New Mexico may have been really good for him, the dry climate. I don't know. I'm not a tuberculosis expert, but he was only 44 when he died, Richard. And he didn't have that much time to produce, even though he produced a great deal in a short amount of time. Was he working on something at the time of his death? Do we know that? And was it ever filled out and published anyway, even without his
approval? Mean, off the top of my head, I can't recall the last thing he was working on, but he wrote right up until the end of his life, and letters, short stories, travel pieces. And those 5 years were very painful. Tuberculosis was, there were very limited medical ways to address it. So there are lots of accounts of, you know, Lawrence, you know, really having trouble breathing, Lawrence knowing he was going to die soon. One of his great poems is about his, you know, knowing you're going to die soon. The poem is that, you know, The Ship of Death. And it's one of the great poems about confronting mortality. So he wasn't scared to think and write about his own mortality. I think that's part of the bravery of Lawrence. And, you know, it is very poignant that he's in his mid-40s when he dies. I put Lawrence in that pantheon of great writers who died, you know, tragically young. Keats, Sylvia Plath, are, you know, two that come to mind. But
Thomas Wolfe, I believe, didn't Thomas Wolfe die Wolfe early? And yeah. I think it was TB. Wasn't it tuberculosis that killed Thomas Wolfe as well?
I'm not sure I know, but it was a common disease, and Lawrence's friend, the writer Catherine Mansfield, also died of tuberculosis. So it was a common incurable illness. And she too died, Catherine Mansfield died relatively young. And she may be a character in Women in Love as well. There are people who think the character of Gudrun, that's the character played by Glenda Jackson in that Ken Russell movie I mentioned. There are people who think that character is based on Catherine Mansfield, with whom Lawrence had a very tumultuous relationship. He was a very difficult man, Lawrence. I mean, he had wonderful friendships, but he would get into fights with people. He had big falling outs with many characters. And, he really, you know, at one point he alienated his friends because he wanted them to all move to Florida, and lived with him in a utopian community. And some of the people he knew said, well, I'm not so sure I want to go off to Florida. This is before people retired to Florida, right?
Yes. Now, let me mention that supposedly, I mentioned Florence, Italy earlier, and supposedly he had a chance meeting when he was there with a guy named Norman Douglas, who gave him the idea about printing and distributing Lady Chatterley's Lover privately. Just print it up. Don't try to go through a publishing company. Distribute privately. And I don't know if he ever followed that advice, or was there a publishing company that accepted it? Did a publishing company end up accepting it and trying to publish it, and it ended up getting, the government stepped in and said, no, you don't?
No, I think it did come out in edition in Italy. I think that story is correct. I mean, he was very concerned about how to get this book out there, and I think the Douglas encounter you're talking about is correct. And now and then, you know, you'll see a copy of the Italian Lady Chatterley's Lover on the book market for, you know, $50,000.
So yeah,
it's very rare. But there was Lady Chatterley's Lover, more than any other of Lawrence's novel, had a rough time. And there are accounts of people smuggling it, you know, getting a copy, smuggling it out to United States. I mean, this is part of the history of modern literature. You know, James Joyce had trouble with Ulysses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was, you know, Joyce didn't like Lawrence's writing. Virginia Woolf said, there's a wonderful quote where she says, he really captures, quote, the heat of life, But anyway, Joyce also had trouble with censors. And that's just part, and also because of sexuality. I mean, I just watched, it was news to me. I just watched the Ken Burns documentary about Hemingway, and Hemingway gets into a lot of trouble with one of his classic stories, Hills Like Elephants, White Elephants, right? Which is a short story about a couple discussing abortion.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And Hemingway gets into huge, and the word abortion is never used in the short story. It's just very obvious that the man is trying to encourage the woman to abort her child. And so that was news to me. And my point is, it's part of the history of modern literature that writers get into trouble with the law, and the brave ones like Hemingway and Lawrence persist.
You know, I believe it was after Norman Douglas had said, just go ahead and print it and distribute it privately, that Lawrence wrote a third version of Lady Chatterley's Lover that was stronger, and it had stronger and more emphatic sexual content. He decided, well, if I'm going to do it privately and I'm sidestepping the authorities, so to speak, I may as well write this the way I really want it to read.
That's right.
So he obviously softened it to some degree, thinking, you know, at least I have a shot if I soften it. But he did a third version that was stronger on the sex.
Yes. And you can, all of those are in print now, and you can read them. You can read all of them. And he was a great reviser. He was a great reviser, Lawrence was, and that can be frustrating for readers, but I think he really, you know, it's part of his obsessive nature that he was always returning to books, even when they, you know, he was quote unquote finished with them, and quite obsessive about it. But yeah, and so in a way, you know, that's an important part of his history. And that's why we have to be grateful for those Cambridge editions of his fiction, because they're true scholarly editions, and they'll show you when he changed a word, when he
What was your favorite novel of his?
My favorite novel, I think for sure, is Women in Love. There's so much in that novel that's new and different, and it's just so powerful, and it's a very it's a masterpiece of modernist writing, and I think it's structured in a way that's makes it very readable. It's about, you know, one way to think about that novel, it's about two couples, and one is on the right radiant path and the other is not. And the novel explores in a very forceful way why certain relationships are life affirming and others are not. So
are life affirming, you know, your microphone is creating almost a blowtorch kind of sound. You said one is life affirming and the other one is what?
I just said not.
Oh, it is not life affirming. Okay. So how will Lawrence be remembered? I mean, here we are all these years later, still talking about D.H. Lawrence. His books are in print. There's audio editions of his books and so on. As you think about the annals of literature, and you're a guy who has studied and writes about the history of the novel, where does D.H. Lawrence land in that whole firmament?
I think he is a pioneer in writing about aspects of humanity that are hitherto, until Lawrence, unexplored. So he's trying to imagine a part of the men and women that they themselves may not be aware of. So he writes what I would call visionary novels, which is they're not realistic in the sense, in the conventional sense of, you know, reproducing from, you know, in fiction, a scenario he finds in life. You know, that's why I'm not so attracted to these, you know, these the perspective that sees him as a biographical writer, you know, writing about his friends. But I think he will be remembered as a visionary writer who tried to bring to his fiction a sense of how great men and women can be in their lives, but how tragically they often fall short of that potentiality. Does that make sense, or is that too grandiose?
No, I don't think so. Well, that's literature, right? Where the grandiosity is part of literature, as well as simplicity. I mean, depending on what you're looking to accomplish. You mentioned, you know, Women in Love. I'm glad to hear that you identified that as your favorite of his books, because that's on deck for me. I'm going to be reading that one very soon, as soon as I'm finished with this Ian Fleming biography that I've been reading.
Well, that's you're going to have experience cultural whiplash there, Mike.
Exactly. Exactly.
From Ian Fleming to D.H. Lawrence, that's quite a...
It's a big stretch.
I would pause for a day in there.
Yeah, I'm going to need to take a day. Yeah, day in the sauna before going on to the next one.
Yeah.
My guest has been Richard Kay, not only professor of literature at Hunter College in Manhattan, but he's also the editor of the D.H. Lawrence Review. Again, it's the 50-year-old journal dealing with the life and work of the famous British writer D.H. Lawrence. Controversial, but as I said at the top, it's so tame by today's standards. Scandalous at the time, tame by today's standards. But the thing to remember is that the quality of his writing is excellent. It's true literature. And if you've never read D.H. Lawrence, I would certainly invite you to do so. And I'm going to put links in the episode notes that you can refer to and find Richard K, his web page, and as well as D.H. Lawrence. I'm not sure if there's a D.H. Lawrence site, Richard,
Yes,
or
there is for the journal, D.H.
there
Lawrence
is.
Review. Yeah.
Okay,
And
I'll have that will be in there as well for you listeners. And go ahead, Richard. I
I was going to
interrupted
say
you.
that's the journal website, dhlawrencereview.org. And that also includes links to other organizations, certain organizations like the D.H. Lawrence Society of North America. So you'll see a lot of links on our journal website.
Fantastic. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time. This was really interesting.
Thank you, Mike.